This is Night Call. Broadcast live with host Russ Gibb and tonight's guest, University of Michigan Associate Professor Richard S. Wheeler. Tonight's subject, the Indo-Pakistan conflict. You participate by calling Night Call's national phone number, 313-846-6601. Now here's Night Call host, Russ Gibb.
Hello, Night People. This is Gibb. Standing by in Ann Arbor, Michigan, is Assistant Professor Richard S. Wheeler of the Political Science Department of the University of Michigan. Dr. Wheeler is a Fulbright Scholar and expert in the political affairs of South Asia. If you'd like to ask Dr. Wheeler a question on tonight's topic, the Indo-Pakistan conflict, or make a comment, call us here at our national night call number. The number to call us at is area code 313-846-6601. The lines are now open. The operators are on duty. Now remember, you may call from anywhere collect. Please make the call station to station. The number is area code 313-846-6601. So we await your call here at Night Call. Area code 313-846-6601. Dr. Wheeler, what's the background of the current Indo-Pakistan conflict?
Well, this is a culmination of friction and struggle which has been going on between India and Pakistan ever since they achieved independence in 1947 over the disposition of the former princely state of Kashmir, which borders on Chinese and almost borders on Soviet Russian territory. This has become an ideological issue for both India and Pakistan because it is tied up with the very basis underlying these two constitutional systems. When British India was partitioned in 1947, Pakistan was created as a state for the Muslim majority areas in the former British Indian Empire. Since the princely state of Kashmir had a Muslim majority, the Pakistanis have always felt that the Pakistan movement or Pakistan itself will not be complete until at least the Kashmiris have an opportunity to say whether or not they would like to become part of Pakistan. While on the Indian side, since India insists that India is a secular state in which people can live together, whether they are Muslims or Christians or Hindus or whatever, they insist it is essential to prove their secular character that this Muslim majority area remain a equal, contented part of the Indian Republic. Both of these approaches have been tied up now with questions of national prestige and honor, always a very dangerous and explosive.
Now, how did the U.S. get involved in this, Doctor?
Well, the U.S. became involved by supporting first one and then the other of these two states militarily, getting involved with the overall East-West Cold War conflict of the 50s. The two countries have naturally regarded each other as their principal enemies, while the United States has always regarded India and Pakistan as potential allies to be developed to use against the Soviet Union or against China at a later stage.
Is that why we've supplied them with the military weapons?
Yeah, that's right. Since 1951, the United States has supplied something more than $5 billion worth of assistance to Pakistan, in large part military aid, which the Pakistanis, of course, have always felt would be primarily for defense against India, their great neighbor who has refused to cooperate in the settlement of this Kashmir affair.
In other words, the Pakistanis have never felt that these weapons were to be used against China.
Not necessarily, no. They were willing when they joined CENTO and CETO back in the early 50s, they were willing to pledge themselves to participate in a resistance against the major Communist Party, Communist power of that time, that is the Soviet Union. But they also, I think, primarily were worried about the power of their neighbor. While for the Indians, the U.S. has provided India with about $6 billion worth of aid since about 1950, most of this economic aid, but this, of course, is certainly freed other Indian resources to be used for the purchase of war material to build an armed force largely directed against Pakistan.
What do we have to gain or lose in this area of the world, Doctor?
Well, we have to certainly to lose any possibility of a real defense of the southern part of Asia against communist influence. The U.S., for the last decade or so, I think, has rather mistakenly gone under the assumption, first, that a resistance to communist influence could be built on one of these countries alone, and then, rather mistakenly, I think, alternating between which country we choose to support most at any particular time. We supported Pakistan for a while, and then when India seemed to come on bad terms with China, then we began to put the most emphasis on supporting India.
You know, this seems like a foreign policy based on trying to figure out what Red China's going to do and not in Red China's interests over and above what is necessarily our best interest in
India. Well, that's very true. I think this complex which the United States has had about China since the communists took over in China in 1949 has clouded our judgment in dealing with other problems in Asia.
Well, now, what do you mean, complex?
Well, I mean that we tend to regard communist China as being an essential evil, and all China has to do is sort of look as if she might be moving in a particular direction, and all other factors are immediately ignored, pushed to one side, and we think solely in terms of our relationship with a possible Chinese interest in a particular situation.
Now, many Americans assume that all China has to do is go across the border and take over India and Kashmir, and that's it. It's that easy. Would it be that easy for Red China to take over India?
I don't think so. For one thing, the question of supporting any forces which might come down across the border through the mountains would be very difficult. The supply lines from the central populated areas of China are extremely long. It would be very difficult for the Chinese to conduct a serious war for any extended period of time in India. In addition to which, after all, India is not a small country. China already has 700 or so million people. India and Pakistan together have something like 600 or so million people. This is not a small task for any government to want to assume.
Now, how is Pakistan related to China? It seems to me that their army is more or less anti-communistic orientation.
Basically, their ideological orientation is certainly anti-communist, and Pakistanis with whom I spoke about this problem while I was there during the last few months emphasized the fact that as Muslims, they are basically hostile to what the communists stand for.
Is this because of their religion?
This is what they say, yes. And they say that as Muslims, they are devout believers in God. The communists are not, and therefore there is no common ground. However, because the United States has seemed to support Pakistan's principal opponent or enemy, that is India, the Pakistanis have felt no alternative but to try to get on better terms with India's principal enemy, that is China.
Well, now, recently they traded some territory.
Well,
back in 62, actually.
Recently, China and Pakistan came to an agreement to define the border between Chinese territory and the portion of the Kashmir state which is controlled by Pakistan.
Now, did they come to this agreement peaceably?
Yeah. This was a process of negotiation which was undertaken, I think, in 1960, dragged on very slowly, and in fact was completed about the same time the Chinese were involved in their little war with the Indians back in 1962.
Now, that's strange. Many people believe that China doesn't negotiate, that she just moves in with force. Now, I have a map in front of me in a nationally syndicated magazine, and as I look at the map, and as I read the map, it sort of shows an area that is occupied by Red China. It doesn't say anything until you read on that they had an agreement on this. It just looks like the Chinese have invaded this area.
Well, the Chinese have come to an agreement with Pakistan. They've come to an agreement with Nepal and with Burma on their various border problems. They have not been able to come to agreement with India. The Chinese, of course, would say this is because the Indians are obstreperous and difficult and basically imperialist and what have you. This, I think, is undoubtedly a Chinese tactic to make India appear to be standing on the wrong foot to contrast the friendly and negotiable attitudes of the Chinese with their other neighbors and the difficulty that China is having with India.
Our guest tonight, Dr. Richard S. Wheeler. Our topic, the Indo-Pakistan conflict. You're tuned to the Night Call Network.
This is Night Call, where you participate by calling Night Call's national phone number, 313-846-6601. Host Russ Gibb will return in 70 seconds with more Night Call.
Look, I'm quite self-sufficient. I made myself what I am, thank you.
But don't you think all of us occasionally could use a little divine or...
Gee, I gotta run. Here's my card, anyhow. I'm a vice president now.
Well, good.
Yes, indeed.
But your name, it's just penciled in here.
Well, there's a big turnover in personnel. You know how it is.
Uh-huh. Well, that's just about how it is in life, isn't it?
Pardon?
We're all just penciled in.
Where you get the idea you could make it all by yourself? Doesn't it get a little lonely sometimes out on that limb without him? It's a great life, but it would be greater. Why try and go it alone? The blessings you lose may be your own.
The preceding was presented by the United Presbyterian Church. This is Night Call, and here is host, Russ Gibb.
Hello again, Night People. Our guest tonight, Dr. Richard S. Wheeler from the University of Michigan, an expert in the South Asia area of the world. And Dr. Wheeler has recently returned from Pakistan. Our topic, the Indo-Pakistan conflict. And if you'd like to ask the good doctor a question or make a comment about the war that's going on there now, give us a call here at Night Call. The number is area code 313-846-6601. Now remember, you may dial us direct, and if you wish, you may make the call collect. The number to call us at is area code 313-846-6601. The operators are on duty, and the lines are open, so let's hear your comment on the Pakistan and India conflict. That I believe, Doctor, is being negotiated right now, and as the latest news that I read on it is that they have agreed to a ceasefire. But how did this thing start over there, Doctor, the recent fighting?
Well, this we have to go back really to the early part of this year when the two countries ran into a little bit of fighting down toward the Arabian Sea on the border between West Pakistan and India. There, and the people probably recall the Iran of Kutch affair, which led to some fighting in April with a lot of charges being traded back and forth about both sides using American military equipment against each other. And this seems to have been probably a more or less accidental development in that this is an area where the border had not been definitely demarcated. The two countries recognized this in an agreement signed in 1960, and I suspect that early this year, for whatever reason, both sides were sending patrols into the area, and as happens in these uncertain situations, these patrols came into conflict. Fighting began on the night of April 4th to 5th, a few shots were exchanged. On April 9th, then there was an attack by the Indians on a Pakistani post, which led to fairly general fighting in that immediate area, which ended in an Indian defeat by the Pakistanis on the 27th of April, when the Pakistanis captured a post, a strong point from the Indians. This, of course, was a great shock in India, and led Mr. Shastri, the Indian Prime Minister, to say the next day in Parliament that if the Pakistanis didn't desist from their aggressive activities and so on, that India would open a new front at a place of their own choosing.
And is this why they moved up to Kashmir? Because this Iran of Kutch looks about 400 or 500 miles away from Kashmir.
Well, the Iran of Kutch was a very difficult place for the Indians to fight. Pakistanis were in a much better strategic and geographic position because the Indian lines were more or less in a marshy area which is about to be flooded by the rains. So in threatening to start an attack in a front of their own choosing, everybody thought this meant that Shastri had in mind an attack perhaps at the Lahore sector toward the capital city of West Pakistan. Well, on May the 1st, the president of Pakistan made a speech in which he commented on Mr. Shastri's statement and said that, wondered, did the Indian Prime Minister realize that such a new front would mean a general and total war between the two countries? And this statement was then taken up by the Indians and distorted in the Security Council by the Indian ambassador to convey the impression that Pakistan was threatening India with total war. Well, this was clarified somewhat later, but nevertheless, Indian forces were massed on the Pakistan border. The Pakistanis, of course, moved their forces up. Things looked very tense during May. Then the British Commonwealth attempted some mediation, and very fortunately, on June the 30th, when President Ayub Khan of Pakistan and Prime Minister Shastri of India were in London, they reached a ceasefire agreement in the Kutch sector.
Now, they're both members of the Commonwealth.
Yeah. As Commonwealth members, they were in London to attend the Commonwealth Prime Minister's Conference. And sort of at that occasion, behind the scenes, the British Prime Minister managed to bring them together and get this agreement.
Isn't it sort of ironic that here are two Commonwealth nations, and we have to pick and choose between them? They're fighting. America has to pick and choose. And yet Russia looks like she may move in and back India in this case.
Yes, it's very ironic, and it's a very difficult situation for both the United States and for Great Britain, since both these countries want to remain on good terms with both India and Pakistan, which is extremely difficult to do, since they are so deadlocked over this very sensitive issue.
Do you think there's any truth to the charge that the Prime Minister of India, Shastri, is politically unsecure, and therefore he had to get involved in a war and to build up his own internal power, and frankly, he has to win it?
Well, it's true that Mr. Shastri's government is not as strong as Prime Minister Nehru had been. The economic situation in India is none too good. The fact that India suffered defeat at the hands of the Chinese in 1962, and then this small defeat at the hands of Pakistan this past spring Kutch had left a very bad taste, a feeling of frustration in India and in the Indian Army. And I suspect there were probably people in the Indian Army who were just itching for an excuse to open that second front that Mr. Shastri talked about back in April. So when things began to build up in Kashmir during August, I think there were probably some people who were all too eager to extend fighting.
How about the Prime Minister of Kashmir, or rather Pakistan? Is he strong politically?
Well, in Pakistan they have a presidential system more or less like we do here in the United States. And so the head of state and head of government is President Ayub Khan, who has been in power since 1958. He seized power, or came to power, as the result of an effective military coup in 1958, and then governed the country under martial law for 4 years until 1962. But in 1962, the new constitution was promulgated, martial law was terminated, and there was legislative elections in 1962. And then early this year, there was a presidential election in which President Ayub was then elected for a 5-year term, and new legislature was elected as well. So I think a fairly stable man, I think what can legitimately be called a democratic basis now. And I think that probably President Ayub's position politically is stronger in Pakistan than Mr. Shastri's in India.
Now, who can win if this gets into an all-out war? Say this ceasefire doesn't work. Do you think will win?
Obviously, India is much the larger of the two countries, about three or four times the size of Pakistan. In terms of resources, manpower, and everything else, India is much stronger. So in a real all-out slam-bang affair between the two countries, I think India would inevitably win.
Now, this is not taking into account Red China.
No. This means, of course, that if this fighting were to continue, were being really backed up against the wall and their existence at stake, I think they would have no alternative but to appeal to the Chinese for intervention, active assistance.
Well, now, didn't Pakistan at one time, Ayub Khan, say to the Congress of the United States that we, meaning the Pakistanis, are the best friends you have in South Asia?
That's right. This is on his visit in 1961. He says, providing you stick by us, we'll stick by you.
Now, what did he mean?
Well, he meant, of course, always Pakistani leaders always had in mind the Kashmir issue. And what he meant, that as much as Pakistan had been willing to commit itself in a very embarrassing way to all sorts of Cold War issues during the 50s, that the United States ought to have the decency to go along and at least attempt to solve this Kashmir issue by applying some pressure on India. And I think this is mainly what President Ayub had in mind, that if we would play fair with them, they would play fair with us.
Well, then, are you saying we haven't played fair with Pakistan?
I think this is the case, because apparently when President Ayub was in this country on his visit in 1961, President Kennedy assured him that there would be no arms assistance given to India or any upsetting of the then existing balance in South Asia without at least prior notification to Pakistan. Well, when the Chinese incursion into Indian territory occurred in the fall of 1962, there was no consultation. The U.S. and Great Britain really started to rush military assistance to India.
And as far as Pakistan was concerned, this equipment would eventually be used against them, is
that's
that right?
The Pakistanis felt that they'd been betrayed. They felt that the Chinese threat was much exaggerated, that the Indians were just trying to exploit this to get more equipment from the West, which they would ultimately use against Pakistan.
Could this be one reason why they sacked our information library today?
Yes, I think this is merely a manifestation of a steadily growing feeling of frustration and betrayal vis-a-vis the United States, which has been quite evident in the last few months. And I certainly noticed it when I was in Pakistan during the first 7 months of this year.
Now, had you been in Pakistan before this time?
Yes, I was there in 1958-59.
Now, what was their attitude toward America at that time?
Oh, well, at that time it was really the sort of the high point of the honeymoon relationship, really. I mean, the United States was in very high standing, and this is, of course, when President Ayub first came to power, and his government was very effusive in their protestations of friendship and standing by the alliances and all the rest of it. But things began to change in 1960-62.
It seems to me that people are easily controlled in today's world if they can turn on their emotions. Two or three years ago, we can be their best friends, and then the next day, their worst enemy.
Mm-hmm.
Are they controlled that much?
Well, I think that I think control perhaps isn't quite the right way to put it, but the press in Pakistan certainly during the last year or so has been quite vocal and quite critical of American policy. Since Pakistani opinion is very sensitive on the India and Kashmir issues, and the U.S. has been linked increasingly as the ally of India, as the main support of India in its various policies toward the incorporation of Kashmir into the Indian Republic. So Pakistanis have been extremely sensitive about this lately, and of course with the present fighting, the present role of the United States in this crisis, present time, Pakistanis, I imagine this has been a demonstration led by student groups from the university in Karachi. They find sort of violent demonstration of emotion a good sort of vent for their energies to attack an information service or other such outward representations of Western power.
Could you say that the Pakistanis then have a blind spot when it comes to India?
That's right, pretty like the blind spot the United States has in regard to China, I think. Pakistanis, when I was there, asked me about this question, why don't you support us on Kashmir? And, why is this problem arise? Why don't you understand our position? And so I would just try to draw the comparison and say, well, you have this emotional problem about India and Kashmir, we have this emotional problem about China. Unfortunately, these two issues have become crossed in international politics.
Our guest tonight, Dr. Richard S. Wheeler. Our topic, the Indo-Pakistan conflict. You're tuned to the Night Call Network.
This is Night Call, where you participate by calling Night Call's national phone number, 313-846-6601. Host Russ Gibb will return in 70 seconds with more Night Call.
Well, I can't this Sunday. I'm playing golf, and the following Sunday, I promise to take the kids to the beach.
Uh-huh.
Man's got to spend some time with his kids, you know.
Yeah, sure.
Besides, we seem to get along just fine without church. You know, it's up to the individual. Gee, look at the time. I got to run. But anyhow, we'll trot along to church one of these days.
Uh-huh. Well, how about 2 weeks from Sunday?
Oh, I never planned that far ahead. 2 weeks, the whole world could blow up by then.
That's right.
Where'd you get the idea you could make it all by yourself? Doesn't it get a little lonely sometimes out on that limb without him? It's a great life, but it would be greater. Why try and go it alone? The blessings you lose may be your own.
The preceding was presented by the United Presbyterian Church. This is Night Call, and here is host, Russ Gibb.
Hello again, night people. Our guest tonight, Dr. Richard S. Wheeler from the University of Michigan. Dr. Wheeler is an expert on the politics of South Asia and recently returned from Pakistan. Our topic, of course, the Indo-Pakistan conflict. If you'd like to ask the good doctor a question or make a comment, give us a call here at our national Night Call number. The lines are open right now, and your call can get through. That's area code 313-846-6601. Now remember, you may call from anywhere collect. Please make the call station to station. The number is area code 313-846-6601. Doctor, the fighting that's going on right now is up in Kashmir. Now this is a little bit different than the fighting that was going on down in the, the Vale of the Ran of Kutch. How did the fighting up in Kashmir get going?
Well, just about the time that the Kutch situation seemed to have been smoothed out this summer, the internal political situation in Kashmir was getting more tense. India, during the past few months, has been taking additional steps to incorporate the portion of Kashmir which they controlled completely into the Indian Republic. Which was, I think, essentially in defiance of the various United Nations resolutions which had been adopted in 1948, 49, and 50 and whatnot, which called for a plebiscite in the state to determine the ultimate fate of that territory. The Pakistanis naturally were very unhappy about this development and have repeatedly brought the question to the United Nations to try to get some pressure exercised on India to stop this course of events. The former Prime Minister of the Kashmir state, Sheikh Abdullah, had left India this spring, had gone to Arabia to make the pilgrimage to the Muslim holy places, and then had visited Great Britain, various other places, and had visited Algiers. And while in Algiers, he had met none other than the wandering Chinese Prime Minister, Mr. Zhou Enlai. This was taken very poorly in India, to say the least. So when Sheikh Abdullah arrived back in India on May the 9th, he was arrested and packed off into detention in southern India. He's a very popular man, so this precipitated all sorts of demonstrations and protests in Kashmir, which, of course, led to arrests of hundreds of people, which was then followed by a civil disobedience movement and generally a very difficult political situation in the Indian-held part of Kashmir. And the demonstrators were planning, as August had approached, were planning to have a special big protest day on August the 9th, which happens to be the 12th anniversary of the day in 1953, when Sheikh Abdullah was dismissed from his office as Prime Minister of Indian Kashmir and was arrested. This being a memorable day, the Indians were afraid that there might be real trouble. And it seems that the Pakistanis decided to exploit this occasion, and in early August, a number of infiltrators crossed the line from the Pakistan-held part of Kashmir, called Azad Kashmir, that is Free Kashmir, crossed the border in hopes of inspiring the Kashmiri people into some sort of Algerian-type rising against the Indian army. The Indians keep about 100,000 troops in Kashmir to make sure that the people stay well-behaved. The Kashmiris aren't very happy with the Indian forces there, but also, like many other people, they don't really want to risk their necks by starting a revolution. So the infiltrators sent over from Azad Kashmir didn't have much luck, and the Indians seem to have been able to round them up, deal with them without too much difficulty. There was considerable blowing up of bridges and burning of villages and so on, but the Indian forces seem to have the matter fairly well under control.
Well, Doctor, we have several callers now. We've had a little bit of difficulty with our lines, but they're now open. And let's go to a listener out in Baltimore, Maryland, listener on WBAL, Mr. R.J. Morgan. Hello, sir. Speak right up. You're on night call. Hello, sir. Your comment? Well, our lines are still jammed here. I'm going to ask the engineer to get a hold of the telephone people and explain that the calls are coming in, but not into our system here. So, Doctor, we'll just go back to our discussion while the engineer checks these things out.
Maybe I can clarify and get a little bit further here.
Right.
That in mid-August, when these infiltrators started coming in, the Indians naturally had to take action against them. So Indian forces crossed the ceasefire line in a couple of places to take Pakistani posts in order, they said, to stop this traffic of infiltration from the Pakistan side. Naturally, this was resented in Pakistan, but nothing was done. On August 24th, the Indians took a few more posts. On August the 28th, the Indians crossed the ceasefire line in force west of Srinagar, the capital of Kashmir State, and occupied a fairly large territory, part of Azad Kashmir, by driving out the Pakistani defenders there. On September the 1st, Indian forces took the crucial Haji Pir Pass, which is located in this bulge. Then, on September the 1st, the Pakistanis reacted for the first time. This was 2 weeks after the Indian forces had crossed the ceasefire line for the first, first time. And the Pakistanis then attacked with tanks in an area to the south, still within Kashmir, but in a place, again, which was more amenable to the use of their force. And their tank attack in the southern sector was extremely successful. And so they drove in about 14 miles and were very close to cutting the only road which leads from India up through the mountains into the valley of Kashmir. If they had succeeded in doing this, that presumably would have wrapped the question up as far as the Indian forces in Kashmir were concerned.
Well, Doctor, let's try another caller now and see whether or not we've got our problems cleared up on our line. We have a caller out in Cheyenne, Wyoming, a listener on KFBC, Mr. Norm French. Hello, Norm. Speak right up. You're on night call. Hello. Some reason our equipment is not taking it into our master board here this evening, Doctor. I'm sorry for this delay. I have a question about the Muslims and the Hindus. Now, is it not true that many Muslims still live in India, which
That's
is predominantly
right.
Hindu?
That's right.
And vice versa, that there are many Hindus in Pakistan?
Yeah.
Now, can this thing possibly lead into a bloodbath?
Well, this is one of the reasons why the Indians say that it is impossible to hold a plebiscite in Kashmir. They say that if the Muslim Kashmiris were to demonstrate by voting that they did not want to remain part of India, then this would seem to prove that Muslims inherently were disloyal to India and therefore presumably would lead the Hindu majority in India to attack the Muslim minority. There are about 40 million Muslims in India. The population is something like, the total population is over 450 million, about 10% are Muslim. So this is a small minority, but in absolute terms, there are a lot of people. And so this is a fear which has been expressed by the Indians, and there's probably something to it, that in a sense, the Muslim Kashmiris must be kept within India in order to ensure the continued safety of the Muslim minority within India. Pakistanis, of course, reject this argument and say that this is a hostage argument, which is, you know, cannot be accepted. They say that, you know, if this is true, this doesn't speak very well for the so-called secular state in India or for the ability of the Indian Republic to defend the rights of its own citizens.
Didn't they have quite a bloodbath back in 47?
Yes, well, this is what everyone bears in mind, the fact that in 1947, when partition occurred, in the Punjab area, in the same area where this fighting has been going on in the last couple of weeks, there was a vast exchange of population involving about 12 million people in all, Muslims moving from the Indian side over to Pakistan, Hindus and Sikhs moving from the Pakistan side over to India. And in this shift of population, a large number of people ranging by different estimates from about a quarter of a million to maybe a million are estimated to have died either by being slaughtered or by disease in the process of moving. So this is a horrible experience, and of course no one wants to see this recur. And I think this is one of the things which the government of India fears, that something might start off that sort of slaughter again in India.
Now, I read a comment in National Magazine that in one part of Kashmir, where the Hindus are in control, that India has a law that the Muslims are not allowed to eat beef, which actually is a traditional Muslim food. Is this true, or is this just a story?
Well, before independence, Kashmir was ruled by a Hindu prince, and so the ruling class were Hindus, and this is one of the laws which is on the books then, yes, that made it a crime for anyone to kill a cow. And this is one of the issues, one of the things which is used an example of the, you know, the oppression of the Muslim majority by this Hindu ruling elite. I don't think the slaughter of a cow would be a crime in Kashmir at the present time, although in many of the Indian states, of course, cow slaughter is forbidden because the cow is sacred to Hindus.
Well, now, standing off in the corner in all this is the Soviet Union. Now, what role is Russia going to play in all this?
Well, for many years, the Russians supported the Indian position on Kashmir. This is, I suppose, largely because the United States was busily providing military assistance to Pakistan, and because India was at odds with the United States, therefore the Russians supported India on the Kashmir question.
Mm-hmm.
However, within the last 3 or 4 years, the Pakistanis have improved their relations with the Russians, and the Soviet Union now has been hedging its position. Taken a more impartial stand, is trying to be on good terms with both, and hence the Russians under present circumstances are in about the same embarrassing position that the U.S. is. That is, they would like to see this battle fighting brought to an end because they don't want to be forced at this point to take sides definitely or one against the other.
If they were forced to, where do you think they'd come in at? On Pakistan's side or India's side? And again, this is a speculation, Doctor.
Yeah,
I realize this.
I suspect that they would probably support India for the same reason that the United States seems to be supporting India in the last few years, mainly that this India is the larger of the two countries, in the long term richer and so on. And that Pakistan is unfortunately smaller and, in most everybody's view, apparently more dispensable. I think this may be an illusory view, but in many cases seems to be one which is commonly held.
Do you think that the British made a mistake originally by agreeing to this partition the way they did?
Well, I don't think there was really much choice in 1947. The political situation had developed so that it would have been impossible to keep a united India, or to keep the former British Indian Empire united in one political community. The hostility between the two major communities, the Hindus and the Muslims, was so intense that, it just failed. The British tried their best up to the end of 1946 to get a unified India constitution accepted by the two major forces. This failed, and hence the quick decision to partition and get out.
Our guest
tonight, Dr. Richard S. Wheeler. Our topic, the Indo-Pakistan conflict. You're tuned to the Night Call Network.
This is Night Call, where you participate by calling Night Call's national phone number, 313-846-6601. Host Russ Gibb will return in 70 seconds with more Night Call.
Busy America! Busy America! Busy making money, busy buying gadgets, busy keeping up with the you-know-who.
Is that your idea of fulfillment? Don't you wonder if there's more to life than just that rat race with no finish line?
Where do you get the idea you could make it all by yourself? Doesn't it get a little lonely sometimes out on that limb without him? It's a great life, but it could be greater. Why try and go it alone? The blessings you lose may be your own.
The preceding was presented by the United Presbyterian Church. This is Night Call, and here is host, Russ Gibb.
Our guest tonight, Dr. Richard S. Wheeler. Our topic, the Indo-Pakistan conflict. And we're having some line difficulty this evening. Our calls are coming into the studio, but we cannot get them onto the conferencing equipment with the good doctors. If you will call in, we will write out your question and then read them directly to the doctor. If you'd like to call us here at Night Call, the number to call is area code 313-846-6601. And remember, you may call from anywhere collect. Please make the call station to station. The number is area code 313-846-6601. Dr. Wheeler, going back to the original premise here, do you think that this war, this ceasefire, is going to last that has been arrived at?
Well, it doesn't seem really quite clear whether the ceasefire has been accepted, because I think the Pakistanis still would like to get some guarantee that when this thing is over, something will be done about Kashmir.
In other words, the plebiscite.
Yeah. Now, they see no point in returning to the status quo ante, and with the same old frustrations and bitterness made even worse by a failure to accomplish anything out of this.
Do you think America has played any role in bringing the ceasefire about?
There has obviously been some behind-the-scenes action, although, of course, President Johnson had said publicly that he thinks everything should be done through the United Nations. Again, this, I think, is in part because he doesn't want to seem to be acting in a way that might offend directly either of the two countries. And the result is, of course, that he's already offending the Pakistanis by not supporting them more directly.
Well, now, what about the Russians? It seems to me that Kosygin said that he would be glad to arbitrate this dispute.
Yeah, we are seeing this novel situation with the U.S. and the Russians being in agreement that they would like to get this thing stopped. And this, I think, is encouraging. And that it does seem that the resolution which has been proposed, which suggests that after the ceasefire has been accepted, then the Security Council will proceed to try to get some settlement of the political problem underlying the present conflict, as the phrase goes. This implies at least the possibility of some action to get a final solution to the Kashmir question. India insists, of course, that no plebiscite is possible, that Kashmir is part of India, and that's that. However, I think that in view of India's economic dependence on foreign assistance, that if the United States and the Soviet Union and the other members of the Security Council act in concert, that they can compel India and compel Pakistan to accept what is agreed to be an equitable solution, and whatever equitable solution they can come to, whether it amounts to participation. yield if Pakistan was, in a sense, asking for 2 or 3 days ago.
Doctor, do you recall that when we first discovered our lines were giving us some trouble, we had a caller from Baltimore, Maryland?
Yes.
Mr. R.J. Morgan. Well, Mr. Morgan has given us his question to our operator, and I'll relay it down the line to you. His question basically was, did India own the Kashmir province originally?
Well, no. In 1947, since Kashmir was ruled by a prince, technically, on August the 15th, Kashmir became independent, and the Maharaja, the prince, was free to stay independent or to join up with either India or Pakistan. He dithered around about it and couldn't make up his mind what to do. There was, well, these versions are conflicting, but in any case, unrest began within the state, conflict between the peasantry and the state army. Then Muslim tribesmen from Pakistan entered to support the Muslim peasantry in their little revolt. The Maharaja got frightened and acceded, that is, joined India in order to get military assistance from India to deal with these tribesmen and with this rebellion. And this accession to India was accepted provisionally by the Indian government, Prime Minister Nehru, and the Governor General at that time, both saying that this was subject to confirmation by the people of Kashmir themselves. And this is the basis of the plebiscite commitment, which Pakistan still insists must be filled.
And this is the one that India said she's not going to fill.
After time, by the middle 50s, India said times have changed, that the plebiscite is no longer possible.
And that's when we find Pakistan getting excited and moving troops about.
That's right.
What about the idea that the Indians have expressed that if they let Kashmir go, that this might be the beginning of the breakaway of many Indian states and provinces?
I think this is a rather bogus issue, because everybody recognizes that Kashmir is in a very peculiar and different position, that it is not on the same footing as the other states in India. And unless the Indian government, by its public relations policy, ties Kashmir to these other issues, why these things need not necessarily be linked.
Doctor, Mr. Norm French from Cheyenne, Wyoming, a listener on KFBC, evidently was a Peace Corps volunteer in Nepal.
Uh-huh.
And his question was, what effect will the conflict have on the smaller countries surrounding India and Pakistan, such as Nepal and Tibet?
If there is an extended conflict between India and Pakistan, I think, this would unsettle the whole region, which couldn't be in Nepal's interest, certainly. I think probably the Nepalese view would be they would like to see a somewhat more stable relationship between both India and Pakistan. And Nepal's general policy, of course, has been to attempt to stay on fairly good terms both with China and with India.
Is it a neutral country now?
It's a neutral country. In the past, there was overwhelming Indian influence in Nepal, and in order to assert its own independence, Nepal has increased ties with China to prove that it is a separate, independently operating sovereign entity.
What about Tibet?
Well, Tibet, of course, is now part of China, and so that question really has been precluded, I guess, by the...
The takeover, then.
Takeover.
And it was a takeover, I assume.
In the 50s.
Okay, we have another caller here, Dr. Wheeler, and it's from Gary Arnold in Fort Lupton, Colorado, a listener on KTLN. And his question is, how much truth is there to the fact that the conflict is basically religious between the two peoples?
Well, it's religious, and it is basically, I guess, in the sense that I tried to point out at the start, there was a feeling that politically the two communities could not get along under one roof, as it were, and as far as Kashmir is concerned, there's the feeling on the two sides of the border in Pakistan that Kashmir ought to have a right to become part of Pakistan as Muslims. And the feeling, on the other hand, in India that Muslims, like Hindus or anybody else, ought to be able to live freely and equally as part of India. It's really very difficult to separate the religious factors from all sorts of other economic and general political considerations here.
Is Sukarno playing any role out in this area of the world today?
Well, he is, but it's sort of peripheral. Sukarno in Indonesia, along with China, of course, had jumped in, verbally at least, to support the Pakistan position rather quickly. And this, in a sense, is repaying the Pakistanis for maintaining a more or less impartial view on the Malaysia confrontation problem, since Pakistan has tended to sympathize with, in a sense, with Indonesia's claim there. The Indonesians are responding by endorsing the Pakistan position on Kashmir. Also, the Indonesians feel a degree of rivalry with India. Sukarno, as some people may know, has renamed the Indian Ocean as the Indonesian Ocean. So you have a possible conflict of imperialisms in that area.
Does Pakistan and Indonesia and these countries look upon India as a stooge of the Western world, as it were?
Well, Sukarno talks that way. I don't think that Pakistan does. And I doubt whether Indonesian policymakers really think that. But this sort of line, which is pressed, certainly in Indonesia, and sometimes Pakistanis will say such things, although I don't think they really believe it.
Doctor, we have about 2 minutes remaining. Could you tell me, ideally, how you feel this problem should be settled?
Well, I feel that there's no point in returning to the situation which existed before this fighting began last month. If you return to the status quo, this means the bitterness remains unchanged and the whole political situation will be worse rather than better. And that I think that although the Indians would be very unhappy and would resist very strongly any departure from their position, that is, that there can be no change in Kashmir, I think that the wiser policy for the U.S. and for the Russians would be to insist and to compel India to accept a plebiscite or some arrangement which would be reasonably acceptable in Pakistan. Possibly this might mean the recognition of Kashmir as an independent or autonomous state. Nepal, Sikkim, and Bhutan are more or less independent states. Perhaps Kashmir could be another in that area.
Dr. Richard S. Wheeler, I want to thank you for being our guest tonight on Night Call. We certainly enjoyed having you here, and you have been a most informed guest. And thank you again for appearing on Night Call.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Dr. Richard S. Wheeler, our guest on
Night Call tonight from the University of Michigan, an expert on the politics of South Asia, our topic, the Indo-Pakistan conflict. Tomorrow night on Night Call, Dr. Edmund J. Glaser, our topic, what kind of education after high school? Until then, this is Gibb wishing you good luck and Godspeed.
Night Call is produced by the Methodist Church in cooperation with the National Council of Churches and this radio station as a radio forum dedicated to the frank discussion of vital issues of daily life. Night Call encourages its participants to express freely and responsibly their own personal opinions.